Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right. Hey, Jose Daniel, alcoholic.
Hey.
Good to be an alcoholic today in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I almost walked out the door without my jacket, and last time that I got to share up Lee, he's my sponsor. He came with me, and I was like, "Oh man, I wore my tie," and he goes, "But not your jacket." I thought the tie was the only requirement, but good sponsorship, right? Good sponsorship. So I'll get sober as fast as I can. Because we all know how to drink, I'm imagining, as horribly as I do. But in order to identify, right? So for me, it all starts with one drink. And it doesn't matter what that drink is, right? It could be a shot or a glass of wine or a beer. I guess it doesn't even matter how much, how big or how little, how warm or how cold, none of that stuff matters. What matters is that it's just that one drink, right? And I put it into my body, and there's two things that can happen to me. The first one is that I'm going to control my drinking. But definitely not enjoy it, right? And usually, like, especially towards the end of my drinking, the way that that looked was that I would be at, like, a function of some sort, maybe a barbecue or a little get-together between friends, something casual, and I have one drink and I have another beer or whatever that might be, and my wife would come up to me and goes, "Hey, I think that's enough right now," right? Because she knows what's going to happen. She knows what's going to happen. And I am a little scared of my wife, so if she catches me at two drinks, I can stop. But you know what two drinks does to me? It just gets me so mad. Like at that point, like it's nothing's gonna cheer me up. Nothing's gonna be good enough for me to have a good time. Like two beers does absolutely nothing. Two drinks, two shots, whatever it might be, does absolutely nothing but get me mad. That's it. The other thing that can happen after that one drink is that I'm going to enjoy my drinking. And the way that I enjoy my drinking is by putting as much alcohol into my body as... it's not even as much as I want. Because at that point, it isn't a matter of want, but as much as my body keeps asking for. And usually when what that looks like is I'm putting as much alcohol into my body as fast as I possibly can. If the alcohol content is really low and my body can't physically put more liquid inside of me, I will force myself to throw up 2, 3, 4 times throughout the night in order for me to keep drinking. At that point, it is not something that I'm doing lightly, drinking. At that point, it is something that I'm doing because it's an absolute necessity. It's an absolute necessity. And I don't stop drinking until there are consequences. And the consequences could be big or small. I run out of money. I run out of booze. It's 2 o'clock and that was last call, right? There's a huge brawl and we have to run scattered everywhere. And, you know, somebody left the liquor behind. I pass out, right? I black out and I don't know when I stop drinking. Like something has to happen at that point for me to stop drinking, especially at the end. There was... some great times drinking. As a matter of fact, I got sober mid-July. July 11th is my sobriety date, 2015. And in June, a bunch of us friends went out to, I think it was the Oyster Fest over at Avila Golf Course. So they shut down. It's a super cool venue. They shut down the golf course. They have, you know, concerts and music and great time. And some of our friends went up there. My wife was pregnant at the time, so we had a built-in designated driver. And we drank a lot. And I drank a heck of a lot. And I had a blast, you guys. It was super, super fun. There was no major consequences aside from my wife rounding us up all and putting us in the car. It took her like 2 hours to, you know, she would get like two of us. There was three of us. And then one of us would get away and she would chase us down, you know, and she laughs about it now. But it was super fun. I had a blast. I had a blast. That was about a month before I got sober. And, you know, I kind of nodded out inside the car. When we get home, she wakes me up. I go to bed. I wake up the next day. Have a couple, you know, to get away from that shaking, that super bad headache. But like at that point, it was just hair of the dog, right? That wasn't bad consequences, right? My drinking started pretty early on. I don't remember my first drink. In my family, we always drank. Alcohol was something that was always part of whatever we were doing. Most of the time, not alcoholically, like I turned out to be. It was a remedy. You know, when kids were teething, they get, you know, a little bit of whiskey. Or brandy or something, you know, to help out with that. I come from the desert, right? Southern California, across the border from Calexico, Mexicali. And it gets like 120 degrees out there. And in Mexico, there's no drinking water out of the faucet. So when we would go out to ranches or wherever, we'd stock up on water, on sodas, on juice, but a lot of beer. And what would inevitably happen is that somewhere along the lines, all the kids, and I come from a big family. My great grandmother was one of 11. She had 10. My grandfather had 14. You know, and there was a ton of us. There was a ton of us. So, but there was always enough beer. And what would end up happening is that, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon when we're all still hanging out, the only thing left to drink is beer, and it was acceptable for us to drink beer as kids, you know, 7, 8, 9, because we didn't want to dehydrate, and it wasn't like an excuse, right? It was 120 degrees out, you have family down there, so you know the heat, right? It's bad. It's really, really bad. So in Christmas time, we would do bonfires. The grown-ups would go to theirs and the kids would go to ours. And the oldest kid would always get like a bottle to keep everybody warm. And he was in charge of making sure that nobody overdid it, right? And that's kind of what we did. I remember when I was 4 years old, I got drunk with my grandma. That was fun. but it wasn't alcoholic. No, we had a good time. We had a good time, my grandma and I. And we would always laugh about it. It's one of the sweet, fond memories that I have of my grandma. Because she would always joke around, you know. So I don't remember my first drink. But I remember the first time that the magic happened, right? I remember the first time that the magic happened. I was 15. I was hanging out with Mike. We were in his garage. And it was me and him and three girls. And we were playing pool. And he brought out a bottle of Goldschlager. And he poured me a triple shot of Goldschlager. I took it down. And it was immediate, you guys. It was like, all of a sudden, like, I knew what life was about. You know? I knew immediately. It wasn't like later on down the road I thought. No, immediately I knew that this was my destiny. This was what I was going to do as a hobby, as what I was going to do for fun. I got super cool and handsome. Like I said, it was me and Mike and three girls. So, you know, what a great, great time to feel that feeling for the first time. It was great. It was great. I think that if I wasn't an alcoholic, I would chase that feeling for the rest of my life. And I try to reach it every single time. If there was no consequences, you know, I'm convinced. I'm convinced that if there wasn't any consequences, that's what I would be doing right now. I always did fairly well. I think the book talks about us alcoholics, you know, being able to earn a good living and you know, be likable and attract great women. You know, it talks about, like, we know how to pick them. And a lot of the stuff, most of the stuff that the book talks about, it talks about me directly about me. The first time that I read the book, I couldn't believe that they knew so much about me. They wrote it in 1938, and it blew my mind that they could speak to me. Right? As my drinking progressed, it was just, you guys know, right? You guys know. The hangovers were more unbearable, so I had to drink in order to be able to function after those, benders, or I would wake up and I would still be drunk from the night before, or not remember the night before. I was a realtor at the time when I stopped drinking for the last few years, and it's acceptable for us to drink and encouraged a lot of the times, right? You deliver a house, it's the biggest purchase of somebody's life, and you show up with champagne, right? You're working on a big deal with contractors, and you know, we're gonna flip houses or whatever it is. You take them out to play golf, and of course you have to drink when you golf, right? Like stuff like that. The escrow office that we used, they knew exactly what I like to drink. And we fed them so much business that they made sure that it was always, always available when I'd go out there. So I would always, it's not a requirement to take your clients to escrow, but I would more often than not do that because it was professional, right? But they knew how to treat me right, you know? So free drinks, right? Free drinks. I did really well in that. I think in the last couple of years that I was a realtor, before I stopped drinking, I was like top five in Santa Maria as far as production goes. I did really, really well for myself there. And I kind of climbed the ladder a little bit in that company. And it was acceptable for us to drink. We would drink at the office, we would drink at golf, and we would go out on the weekends, barbecue. Super, super great place to work at, right? But I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I will do everything to excess, and it doesn't matter the consequences. So it all culminated on July 10th. It was my mother's birthday. I didn't even call her. They were throwing a party for me because I was opening up my own office. They had spent like $50,000 on this new office. And, you know, they invited a bunch of people to the Santa Maria Inn, and they rented the banquet room, and afterwards we were all gonna go to an open bar over at the tap room. Everything was great leading up to that. A lot of stress, right? But I get out there, a couple of deals didn't go through quite the way that I wanted. I'm drinking during the meeting before, you know, they open up the tap room for us to drink at that point. But I already had a flask in my pocket because that's what I do. That's what I do, right? And I got up to talk, and the owner of the company, my boss, cut me off because I was too drunk. I was too drunk to talk. And I sat down and I was just fuming because this is my party, right? This is my party. If I want to talk, right, we know what alcoholics think when we get shut down, right? And so after the meeting, everybody goes into the tap room. I pull them aside. We're about to get in a fist fight. And the Santa Maria Inn and the Santa Maria Inn people come in, and they're like, hey, you two have to go. So the guy that's paying for the party, he's getting kicked out of the Santa Maria Inn. And the guy that they're throwing a party for is getting kicked out of the Santa Maria Inn. We haven't even made it to the tap room, right? and he starts making a fuss about, you know, hey, I'm paying for this whole thing. I'm dropping a lot of money here. And so I go, hey, let him stay here. And I leave. I punch a wall. I break my hand. I walk home. I just didn't want to be anymore. It's not that I wanted to die. It's just that I didn't want to be anymore. I didn't want to be in my shoes. I didn't want to be living the life that I was living. And I had a good life. I was driving a Mercedes. I had a few suits that were pretty fancy. I own my house. My wife is beautiful and pregnant, right? Like I had, money in the bank. I had money coming in. I had worked really hard at a career that I was successful at. But it didn't matter anymore, you guys, because alcohol had just taken every ounce of happiness at that point, right? At that point. So I went around the house and I grabbed every bottle of pills that I had. I had a really fancy bottle. I'm super happy that like my last drink was a cool one. It wasn't like a spritzer or something. I had a 1963 bottle of single malt Scotch whiskey, right? And I drank about 3/5 of the bottle, washing down every single pill that I could find in my house. I don't know what happened, but this is what my wife tells me. My wife tells me that I went into the bathroom to take a shower. And when I didn't come out after a while, she checked. My wife is 5'2", and at the time, she probably weighs 100 pounds, and she's pregnant, right? I don't know how she opened the door, but she says she found me naked on the floor with the water running. I don't know how she dragged me out of the shower. I don't know how she got me dressed. In such a panic, she didn't even call 911. She got me dressed, and she dragged me into the car and took me to the emergency room, right? This is what she tells me happened. But I don't know what happened. The next thing that I remember is I wake up and, you know, you hear the sounds of a hospital, and I've been hospitalized enough times to recognize what that is. And the first thing that runs through my head is like, you can't even do that right, right? Like, you can't even like take your own life because you're that much of a failure, right? And like, the thought of me having to live this existence one more day was just unbearable. And I was still convinced at that point that I didn't want to be around, right? And I looked up and my wife is sitting at the edge of the bed and she says, I can't do this without you, right? And it just breaks my heart. I disappoint this woman time and time and time and time again. And it breaks my heart to hear her say that, but even more so, it tears me up inside to know that that's not the last time that I'm gonna do that. Because as long as I'm alive, I know that I'm gonna continue this pattern, right? This pattern that starts with one drink, you guys, one drink. That's all it starts for. And this feeling of waking up, and you guys know that feeling, I don't even have to describe it, right? Like, if you were to ask me if I was gonna change my life in any of those moments, like, I would pass a lie detector test, and I'd tell you that that is the last time that that was gonna happen. That I was gonna do everything in my power to ensure that I didn't feel that way again, that I didn't hurt those people like that again, that I didn't behave that way again, right? And I would have passed that lie detector test, right? It wasn't a lie. It wasn't a lie, but at that moment when I woke up and I heard her say that, I knew that this was gonna happen time and time and time again. Because that's what history showed me, right? And I didn't know any other way aside from not being around anymore, right? That was still a good idea. That was still a good idea. Anyway, so as much of you know, when you try to kill yourself, they put you in a hold for 72 hours, and they're gonna send me off to the psych ward for longer than that. And so the last person before they sent me off comes in. He's a psychiatrist. He sits down with me, and I lie really, really good. I think that a lot of alcoholics, not you guys, but a lot of alcoholics are really good liars, and I fit into that category. And he believed me. He believed me when I said that I was going to get sober and seek mental help, help for my mental disabilities, right? Get on the right medication, go to the right therapist, just stop drinking altogether, because that's the problem. I really wasn't convinced that that was the problem. I think that there was a lot of other problems than, you know, my childhood and trauma and, you know, my mental instability because of this defective brain that I have, right? But alcohol, like, yeah, it contributed, but it's not the problem, right? I'm not convinced I'm an alcoholic at that point, because I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I would probably say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic because I drink too much. And they believe me, and they decided to let me go after those 72 hours, right? And so I'm super happy because I don't have to stay in the hospital anymore. And right, you guys know. So we get home, and I walk into the house, and my wife looks at me, and she has this, like, happiness to her face, and she goes, I am so glad you're finally going to get help. I am so glad you're going to get sober. And she read back to me the actual things that I knew I was lying about to a doctor. I didn't realize that she was outside sitting next to or standing next to the door and heard everything. And you know what hit me? Boom, you're going to do it one more time. You're going to disappoint her one more time, right? So I pull up my phone and I go, all right, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, Santa Maria, California. And there was one at 8 o'clock at the Golden Group when it was over by the library, a newcomers meeting. I'm going to go to this meeting, right? I didn't want to get sober. What I wanted to do was not disappoint her one more time. And I was about to, two more minutes when I would have opened up, you know, that bottle that I didn't finish 3 days before would have been crushing to her, right? So, all right, let's go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So I get to Alcoholics Anonymous July 11th, I didn't drink, 12th, July 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, right? Somewhere around there. It's a Monday. I walk in. The meeting's real small, so it's not too intimidating. It's like 6-7 people. I still remember the people that were there. One moved away, and I don't know if he's still sober, but nobody else is. Nobody else is. Mm-hmm. How lucky am I? How lucky am I that even though they're not here right now sober, that they were there to open up the doors and bring a message of weight and hope to a hopeless alcoholic like me, right? I still don't want to be around. I still don't want to stop drinking, right? And you know what's funny? The topic of the meeting was rigorous honesty, right? And I'm like, a few hours ago, I was lying to this dude that believed me, and he's kicked me out. And the reason that I'm here is because, you know, my wife believed my lies, right? And that's pretty much what I said, you know, and like not happy and smiling because, you know, I was in a pretty bad spot. But I said, hey, you know, like I just lied through my teeth. I still want to die, you know. I don't know what else to do aside from die, you know. And my wife believed me, so I lied to her one more time, right? What I remember is that when you guys started speaking, like, I knew that you knew. I knew that you knew. I knew that you knew, right? I still didn't want to get sober, but I walked away from that meeting feeling that feeling that you get after a meeting, right? I get goosebumps. I remember that feeling walking away from my very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the same light that I remember that drink doing its magic in Mike's garage. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, the magic happened, right? I'm not even looking for it. Right? There's a lot of people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous and say, well, I'm not here for the right reasons. I'm doing it for them, so it's probably not going to work. I'm here on a court card. Or maybe I have said that, right? Well, he's not going to stay sober because, you know, he's here on a court card. He doesn't even want to be here. He's here for his kids, his wife. As soon as he gets back into the big bed, he's going to, you know, do what I know he's going to do, right? He's going to go back and drink. But the reality is that I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. What I know is that you know. I don't know what you know, but you're not drinking, and you seem to be pretty happy and laughing about the misery that you lived. And I'm not laughing at anything at that point, right? And you say, get to a meeting tomorrow. I go, okay. So I get to a meeting at 8 o'clock, and you say, there's a meeting at noon. I go, all right. And then you say, hey, there's Lion's Den, right? Like, or no, 5:30. So I get to the 5:30 and they're like, Lion's Den. And so I get out to Lion's Den. That's where I meet Lee. That's where I meet, where's Jack? Oh yeah, there he is. As a result of that meeting, I met Jack. I think there's a couple of other people that I still talk to today and hang out with today. That I met at that meeting. But what's really, really important about that meeting is that I recognized somebody that I used to drink with, right? I used to hang out with this girl. Her mom had a friend her friend was married to this guy that I drank with, right? And I saw him at the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And afterwards, I go, hey, how's it going, man? He goes, what's up, dude? Hey, you know? He's super happy to see me. He goes, anything you need, you let me know. If you need help, I'm here to help. And I go, all right, great. And I turned around and I took two or three steps and I realized that I needed help. I turned around and I walked up to him and I go, hey, you know what? I need help. And he goes, I will be your sponsor, right? And he goes, you know what you need? You need a big book. You need a 12 and 12. I go, okay. He goes, you need to call me every day. I go, all right. And you need to work steps every single week. I go, okay. How's Saturday? I'm like, it's great, right? And at that point, I didn't know how Alcoholics Anonymous worked. All I knew is that you're telling me to get to a bunch of meetings every single day. So I'm getting to a bunch of meetings every single day because my boss doesn't want me at the office anymore. Surprise, surprise, right? So, and I have enough money in the bank to be able to pay the bills. And, you know, there's still deals that are coming in. So, you know, my life is Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody ever told me, hey, it's okay not to go to 4 meetings a day. Right. I figured it out later on down the road, but by that time it was too late. It was too late to realize that most people don't go to that many meetings. Most people go maybe one meeting here and there. Right. Most people aren't in the big book right off the bat. Most people aren't trying to understand the 12 steps as they're laid out in the first 164 pages and as they're expanded on in the 12 and 12. Most people aren't working steps. Most people don't listen to their sponsor and follow their directions, right? Most people aren't making like pretty good clip knocking those steps out like in the beginning of recovery, right? Like by the time that I realized that that's not what most people in Alcoholics Anonymous do and that I wasn't required to do it, right? The magic had already worked. The magic had already worked. Like, I didn't have a desire to drink. And by the time that I realized that most people weren't doing the 12 steps the way that they're laid out in the first 164 pages, it was only a couple of weeks, but I still had that bottle with this much whiskey in it, and it was just a liquid in my house. It wasn't calling my name. I wasn't obsessing about where I'm going to sit and have my next drink. Like, this thing that we do works. If you don't want to get sober, but if you have a sponsor lead you through the 12 steps and you do the work, you're going to get sober. And that's how it works. I didn't want to, and that's my experience. And that's why I say that this thing works, right? But it doesn't work without constant effort. There's a couple of things that I really like about the big book. And it explains things really, really, really well. And I think that the beginning of working with others is one of them. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with other alcoholics. It works even when all other activities fail. Ensures. Right? Intensive work? Is that what it said? Intensive work with other alcoholic ensures, right? That's pretty big right there. And when should you start working with other alcoholics? During the first days of your convalescence. This will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else, right? It doesn't say 30 days or after you do 90 and 90. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say, 12 steps, 12 months. It doesn't say any of that stuff. It says during the first days of your convalescence, right? And that's what I did. That's what I did because I didn't realize that there was anything else that was an option. I didn't know these were suggestions. Nobody told me, right? They just told me, hey, get to a meeting. Here's a big book. I'm your sponsor. Call me every day, right? And I didn't do this thing, not even right? I kicked and screamed. I fought, right? Lee one time goes, why do you always do that? Why do you always contradict what I'm saying? Why are you always looking for an excuse? And I was like, oh, that's what I've been doing, right? Like for 5 years, right? Every single time that my sponsor said something, I had a rebuttal. Yeah, but, you know, and at that point, it hit me. And that's something that happens on a regular basis. I've been here for 9 years. And like, it still happens on a regular basis that something that's plain in the big book that you guys talk about all the time, like all of a sudden makes sense. Or like, I didn't even hear it, right, for years. And then all of a sudden somebody says it again and it makes sense. I'm like, oh yeah, right? 1 through 12 works. 1 through 12 works, right? The 12 steps says that we have a spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps, and that we keep that spiritual awakening when we practice these principles in all our affairs and we share this message with another person, right? That's kind of the gist of it all. You do the 12 steps and then you pass it on and you get to live a happy and fulfilling life for the most part. For the most part, right? But whenever you're sitting in misery, 1 through 12 works. 1 through 12 works, right? There's a lot of promises in the book. And my favorite promises aren't even the promises that we think about being promises and that we were in the meetings. My favorite, those are the 9-step promises, by the way. So you got to do the 9 steps in order to get the 9-step promises. There's some promises on step 10 that I absolutely love, right? And there's a ton of them. There's a ton of them, right? We cease fighting anything and everyone. And then it goes on, but like about a paragraph later, we have not even sworn it off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. And that's where I'm at right now. This alcoholic problem has been removed. It does not exist for me, right? But it's not a constant, right? Because if you go a little bit further on down, this is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition, right? So this is what fit spiritual condition looks for me today. I wake up in the morning. The very first thing that I do is roll onto my knees. I'd say I do that 300 days out of the year, I do my prayers. God grant me the serenity. God, I offer myself to thee. My creator, I'm not willing. Lord, make me of channel of thy peace. My creator, I'm not, no. And then the last one is, my Lord God, I have no idea where I am going, right? Those are all the prayers that I do in the morning. My wife is pregnant again. We're expecting a boy. Gifts of the program. Gifts of the program. That happened for 2 reasons. Well, more than 2 reasons. That happened because, one, I'm still alive and I didn't kill myself. And two, because I haven't taken a drink. And everything else, it's a consequence of those things. So I'll say a little prayer. For my wife, I'll say a little prayer for Luca. I'll say a little prayer for my daughter. Usually though, I do those prayers 300 days out of the year. The other 65, I wake up late. I went camping one time and it was 5 in the morning and there was people already up and I felt embarrassed that I might kneel before my creator and pray in front of people. That weighs on me, but you know what? Me and God are pretty cool, and I'm sure he thought it was funny. You know, hey man, I saved your life. I give you a good program for you to work that, as a result, you're happy, and you're a little scared to pray in front of people, right? And I'm like in front of like this beautiful lake in the wilderness, like, you know, the sun is coming out from the clouds and touching my head. Oh, you know, like I can't pray right now, right? Or my daughter, if I'm asleep and she wakes up, it doesn't matter what time it is on a weekend, she will jump on top of me and start screaming, breakfast! You know, so it's a little difficult to do that. But the other 300 days of the year, that's how my morning starts out. I head to my favorite seat in the house, which I sit at every single morning when I pull out the daily reflections. I read the daily reflections. I reflect on them a little bit. I meditate for 30 seconds or a minute. That's probably the weakest part of my program is meditation. Then I get ready for the day. Usually Monday through Friday, I wake up my daughter and get her ready to go to school because I want my wife to hang out in bed and rest a little bit. And this has happened since my daughter's first grade, I guess. When she's ready to go to school, there's been a lot of kicking and screaming and yelling. But I try to remain calm. But, you know, 8-year-olds make it difficult. But most of the time, 300 days out of the year, I can do that without losing it. Anyways, that's funny. Yeah. Then we get into the car, and she goes to parochial school. She goes to St. Mary's over there. I'm really happy that there's a whole community over there. They're teaching her spirituality and this concept of God. And she connects with him, which I never did. And I went to catechism. I went to church, and nuns hit me in the knuckles and, you know, try to... That helps... little bad kids behave like me. I don't think they can do that anymore. Anyways, so she goes over there. She goes over there, and this spiritual awakening that I felt after doing the 12 steps, this connection with a power greater than myself that I choose to call God, she just has it naturally, you guys. She just has it naturally. Like, every once in a while, she just busts out in prayer, and she doesn't even know she's praying because it's so natural. So we're in the car. I go, hey, are you ready? She goes, yeah, I'm ready. So we start off with the Serenity Prayer. Then we go into the Act of Contrition. The Lord's Prayer. And then at the end, we say a Hail Mary in English and in Spanish in order to keep the language is flowing there. I ask her a question, and it could be something deep. And she asked me another question. The last question she asked me was super profound. She asked me, why are trees different? And I go, because that's what God wanted, baby. She goes, yeah, all right. And the reason that I say this about my daughter, right, is because this is part of my program. I feel the closest to God when I'm hanging out with her. And here's another one. Whenever I feel separated from God, whenever I don't feel his presence in my life, right, whenever I feel apart from him, away from him, usually is because I am separated from you. Usually is because I've built space between me and you, right? And the best way that I think that I connect with God again is by connecting with you, right? I drive guys from detox back and forth to meetings, and there is, not every single time, but a lot of the times during that 5-10 minute drive back and forth, there is a presence that is bigger than me and bigger than them in that car ride that I feel, right? It is very difficult for me to be feeling sorry about me when I pick up a guy that has, or guys that have absolutely nothing. Right, that are living in a facility with other addicts and alcoholics because they're clinging on to life with every breath that they have and struggling, right? It is very difficult for me not to see the hands of God in my life and in their lives, right? When I pick them up and I'm able to afford a nice truck or my little car and gas, right? It is very difficult to not remember waking up that day and understanding that I am such a loser at that point that I can't even take my own life, right? Because I've been in mental hospitals multiple times, and I've been institution after institution after institution with medical professionals and mental health professionals that were telling me, like, that there was a way for me to feel better, right? And they were telling me what the book said, not this book, or the big book, right? Or that big book, right? But they were telling me, like, medically what was wrong with me and mentally what was wrong with me, but it didn't make sense. Right. And I get here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and some garden variety drunks knew the answer knew the answer, right? That's what my spiritual fitness routine looks like most days, right? I don't pick up the guys most days. I pick up the guys once, maybe once a week or every other week, or, you know, I get to a lot of meetings. I was getting to about, I don't know, 7 meetings a week. My work, the schedule has changed, and I'm probably getting to 3 to 5 meetings a week now, which is some of the lowest meeting attendance that I've had in 9 years. I meet with my sponsor almost every week. Stuff comes up as well. I touch base with newcomers. I'm always available. If my calendar is open and it doesn't inconvenience my daughter or my wife, then my time is yours. And if my calendar is available and it doesn't inconvenience my daughter or my wife, my time is almost anybody's, right? My daughter's school, I'm really involved there because my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends on constant thought of others and what I can do to help meet their needs, right? This thing is the only reason that I'm alive. This thing is the only reason that life makes sense. This thing that we do, that thing, 1 through 12, right? This big book, following the instructions that are, you know, of the simple program of action that are laid at our feet, right? Has done this for a drunk like me. I want to keep it going. I want to keep it alive, not only for my benefit, but for yours. Not only for my children, but for your children, right? This thing is hereditary. We see it a lot in here, right? I have my daughter. I have a boy in the way. When I look at my daughter, she reminds me so much of me when I was a kid. And it scares me. And it scares me, right? Because at her age, I was drinking. I was drinking, right? I like the effect at her age, right? And like, it is just so crazy for me to think that one day she's going to grow up and more than likely have a drink, right? And I don't want it to be, it all starts with one drink for her, right? But if it does, I hope that you're here. I hope that you're here, I hope she doesn't figure out that you don't have to go to 4 meetings a day, and I hope she doesn't figure out that you don't have to do the 12 steps out of the big book with the guidance of a sponsor until it's too late, and then the magic has happened already in her life. But hopefully she doesn't, but, you know. I try not to get too ahead of myself. Right? She's 8. But like, life is here, right? Life is in session. And we have some of the gifts in sobriety, right? I've already talked about, you know, I have a beautiful daughter. I have a wife that hasn't divorced me. And she's pregnant, so she likes me some of the time. Right? I've gotten a master's since I've been here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten a full ride to go back to school. And I'm in Arizona State University online now, getting degree number 6 and 7. Right? Yeah. You know where I work part-time? With the guy I almost got into a fist fight in Santa Maria Inn. And I didn't go looking for that job. He actually reached out to me, right? And I said no for about a year. And then I said, maybe a little bit, right? And then, you know, 6 months later, I'm like, hey, listen, I think it's time, right? So I go in there and, you know, I get laid off like a week later from my other job, right? And at that point, you know, it's okay because God's going to take care of me, right? I do Uber now as well as work over there part-time. And that wouldn't have happened if an alcoholic didn't tell me, hey, you know, Uber might be a good idea, right? And that was like 9 years ago, you guys, right? I get laid off. I have like the possibility of, you know, facing no income whatsoever, and God comes through because He already set me up 9 years before with this little gig, and also because I had made such an impression leading up to our almost fist fight in Santa Maria Inn, but I had also made another impression after I got sober with this person that he was willing to reach out and ask me if I'd be willing to join his team again, right? And I can keep going on and on and on about all these little things that seem insignificant at the time that they're happening, right? But, you know, in hindsight, like, it has God written all over it, right? Like He molded it all little by little, right? And if I'm going to leave you with anything, is this: whatever's right in front of you, do it. Just do it. It doesn't matter what it is, right? It doesn't matter if you think it's going to have the intended results. If it is right in front of you, right, then do it. Then do it. God will catch you. God will catch you. If you're having that obsession to drink, right, and it's weird for me to call it an obsession because, like, it's just that natural thought that comes to me, you know. 1 through 12 works. Whether you like it or not, 1 through 12 works, you know. And you know what's funny? You do 1 through 12, God removes you from that drink, right? And then all the other things seem to start falling into place. This thing, as it's laid out in the first 164 pages, those instructions work. They have worked for me. They have worked for numerous alcoholics in this room, and it has been working since like 1938. And if it doesn't go the way that you want it, there's always the next drink. You don't lose anything, right? Give it a shot. Give it a shot. God will work. God will work. Whether you like it or not, if you do the work, God will work. Thanks, you guys. Yeah.